He kōna I purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Atamaria, good morning. It's Corin Dan here. Welcome to today's episode of the Morning Report Essentials podcast. Lots of crunchy news this morning, but perhaps the most intriguing story is that of a swipe card lost by an RNZ staffer that ended up in Antarctica, Ingrid.
Yeah, such a mystery. This one got the text machine going, everyone coming in with their theories. Some pretty dubious ones about sort of albatross and various forms of wildlife transporting this swipe card down to Antarctica. We don't know what happened. It is such a mystery and such a great story.
Somebody transported it down there is my theory. I just can't say who.
Yes, exactly. So that is a great listen that is coming up in the episode. Also, as Corin mentioned, of course, some of the crunchy issues of the day, resource management changes, and also a good look at what's going on with this gang law, a bit of pushback on that too. But do enjoy the episode. Well, the Labor Party says the government's first changes to the Resource Management Act are short-sighted and put short-term profits ahead of environmental protection. Farming, mining and other industrial regulations are being scrapped or altered under the amendment to the bill, which will be introduced to Parliament next month. The government says it'll ease the burden for farmers around stock exclusion, winter grazing and healthy water obligations. Labor Party leader Chris Hipkins is on the line with us now. Kia ora, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Federated Farmers has described the status quo, well, your government's rules, as a war on farmers. It says this is the end of that war. How do you see it?
I think it's absolute nonsense. I think one of the reasons that we've seen improvements in things like winter grazing was because we did raise the standards that were required. I think the fact that that has worked isn't good justification for removing the regulation. We don't take that approach to law and order. If we make a law change to make something illegal and then people stop doing that, we don't then say, oh, well, okay, people aren't doing that anymore, we might as well do away with the law. And that's effectively what the farmers seem to be arguing at the moment. So, you know, I don't think that the intensive winter grazing practices that we've seen in the past, where you've had cows knee-deep in mud, is actually acceptable. And I think that the fact that we worked as a government to stop that from happening, and the fact that it's actually delivered good outcomes, is something that we should celebrate.
Do they have a point that some of the rules were complex? They say they were rushed through 8 amendments put through over 3 years.
I think we can always look at how we can streamline things and improve things, but I think that what the current government are doing is saying, oh, let's just abolish the regulations altogether and leave it over to the farmers, when we know that, you know, past practices, particularly around issues like intensive winter grazing, were actually really detrimental.
Well, they're saying these rules would be on a more localised footing rather than a one-size-fits-all, which was the one of the gripes from the farming community, that it was just blanket restrictions that weren't always fit for purpose.
I mean, we'll work through the detail of the bill and scrutinise exactly what the government are proposing. But ultimately, I mean, I don't agree with the notion that because there's been an improvement, that's a basis for doing away with the regulation altogether. And then, you know, what we're seeing from the government overall in this space is a prioritisation of interests other than the environment in making decisions that affect the environment. Ultimately, you know, as a parent, I want to know that the planet that my kids inherit is at least as livable as the planet that we currently have, and preferably more livable given the damage that's been done to it over successive generations. They're certainly not getting that reassurance from this government.
Do you think farmers care about the environment?
I think many farmers do, and in fact, we've seen huge improvements in our, you know, farmers' performance when it comes to environmental issues in recent times, and government regulation's actually been one of the things that helps to drive that forward.
Emergency management, obviously, this damning review out yesterday with the, dismissing emergency management is not fit for purpose. What responsibility do you take, or does your government take, for having it in that state?
I think emergency management in New Zealand over a long period of time. We weren't the only government to conduct a review here. This was a review kicked off under our government. There's been no shortage of reviews, and they've all come back and found that we need to continue working to improve the emergency management system. The reality is every emergency that we've dealt with in recent decades has been different, and it's highlighted different weaknesses in the system. We also need to have an honest conversation about that, though. We don't have a standing army of people sitting there waiting for an emergency to happen. When an emergency happens, it's largely volunteers in the first instance who kick into gear and actually make, you know, lead the emergency response and provide the support at the front line to those who have been affected.
Why is it like that? I mean, you've been in government. Why wasn't that addressed? I mean, some of these holes around the professionalism of the response team, also around communication, the 111 system, were pointed out.
Yeah, I think one of the big weaknesses in the system, and it's certainly something that we were looking to address, we've got legislation before the House at the moment, which I understand the current government are not proceeding with, and one of the big weaknesses in the system is it's largely left to local government to do that. And record, you know, a past record across the country shows that local government haven't done a very good job of that, and they haven't been adequately resourced to do that. Second, I guess, flaw, which again we identified during the flooding and the cyclones, they happened a few weeks after I became Prime Minister, was that actually the National Emergency Management Agency, NEMA, didn't have a lot of ability to direct the response. So it was really the local councils where all the power sits in terms of directing an emergency response, even if the expertise sits at the national level.
You mentioned the legislation you had drafted. Well, the government says that's falls so far short, it's full of so many holes it needs to be scrapped and completely rewritten. Do you accept that?
Well, I'd like to see a detailed explanation of where they think it falls short and, you know, what exactly they're proposing to do differently. I think it does address a lot of the issues, particularly around the fact that the National Emergency Management Agency didn't have the sorts of tools to be able to step in and respond in events like the flooding and the cyclones. It does address those issues. You know, a throwaway slogan like that means nothing. I mean, what we're seeing at the moment is government by slogan. If they think it falls short, then say exactly how they think it falls short, and it can probably be improved.
Appreciate your time this morning. That was Labor Party leader Chris Hipkins.
Well, the government's proposed anti-gang laws are facing pushback from lawyers, rights groups and former gang members. Parliament has been hearing submissions on the Gang Legislation Amendment Bill, which would ban gang patches and allow police to stop gangs congregating. Many at a Justice Select Committee yesterday pointed to years of reports that assess what drivers of crime are and gang membership, and they called for an approach that targets those aspects. We're joined now by Police Minister Mark Mitchell. Kia ora, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Corin.
There were a number of submitters yesterday who felt that just the bill, that how workable it will be, was at issue here. Are you considering any changes, such as that recommended by the Free Speech Union about narrowing just exactly who is a gang and making it clearer as to who is determined is a gang?
Well, I mean, it's obviously a select committee process, so those are submissions to the select committee. They will then provide a report back on the submissions that they've heard, and we will look at any of the recommendations or any of the sort of information that flows from that.
Does it worry you that a number of legal groups, Free Speech Union and others, are saying this is bad law?
Not at all. It doesn't worry me at all. We're very committed. We're going to be banning gang patches in our country. There's only one reason why they wear them, and that is to try and frighten and intimidate the communities that they're in. And by the way, there's a trail of tears flowing along behind those gang patches, because they don't just get them handed out. They have to show that they've got a propensity for violent crime. Rape used to be often a pathway towards getting a gang patch. And we want them gone.
Yeah, I understand all of your arguments, but the argument again is that the law itself is bad law. It won't actually do anything. It won't address those issues, and there are better ways to do it.
Well, we think it's very good law. We think that the gangs in this country feel that they're above the law, and I think when you see their response to our proposed banning of gang patches, it's very clear that we've got a problem here, that they do think that they're above the law and they don't have to abide by it. And we're sending a clear message that we are getting rid of one of the instruments to intimidate communities.
There was a good example given yesterday at the committee, wasn't it? Because I think it was Eugene Ryder who fronted up wearing a number of different T-shirts that had gang insignia or suggested that. And there was a question, an open question, as to whether any of those would come under the new law. And that is the difficulty that is going to be faced here.
I don't think it's going to be difficult. I think that you have got a list there of gangs in New Zealand, and any gang insignia or gang patches associated with those gangs are going to be banned from being publicly displayed and used to intimidate members of the public.
So what happens when someone wears a black T-shirt with a piece of red on it or a piece of blue on it that is obviously...
Well,
What?
If you want to wear, if you want to fill your boots, if you want to wear a black T-shirt or a red T-shirt, you go for it.
And you don't see that as potentially being an issue if that is used nevertheless to intimidate because it's worn by someone who was a gang member?
But if they put swastikas and gang insignia and mongrel mob and black power and headhunters or whatever other gang you want, then it's gone.
Just very quickly before we move on to some cyclone issues, there was a story too, I think it was News Hub running yesterday, about police actually wanted you to go further, allow them to search and seize gang paraphernalia on premises after they'd suspected someone might have broken this gang insignia law. Would you go that far?
Well, the police wanted a search power, and I agree with that. They need to have a search power, so, and they've got that in the bill. So if gang members choose to ignore our police officers, and they've been threatening to do that, and unfortunately in this country we've arrived at a place where gang members do think that they can threaten our police and threaten members of the public and think they're above the law, they're not. And if they choose not to comply with frontline police officers when they're told to remove the patches from public view, then the police now will have a search warrant
for 7 days?
Their houses and search their houses.
Because that was what was recommended, 7 days afterwards.
No, they can apply for a search warrant immediately.
No, I understand that, but it's for up to anyone suspected displaying gang insignia for up to 7 days. It's quite a wide ranging, law. Is that something is possible?
Well, we want to put as much pressure on gangs in this country as we can. So that is something that's in front of the Select Committee, and the Select Committee can come back with any recommendations.
Okay. To the issue with the cyclone and a number of recommendations now before you, what would you see as the top priority that may not require a full rewrite of the law, which is what you're doing, that is going to make people feel safer in the short term? What's something you can offer people up this morning?
Well, I just think that obviously one of the things highlighted in the report was refocusing of NEMA, and look, we'd already started doing that as an incoming government. Professionalisation, obviously, of comptrollers and people involved in leading emergency management. That's something that we can roll out and start working on immediately. But obviously, the heavy lifting, the really important work, is going to be around putting together a proper fit for purpose, world class emergency management legislation, and that is why I went to Cabinet and asked for that bill to be discharged. It became the current bill that was in front of the Select Committee. It was very clear that it sort of was on the fringes. It needed a lot more work done on it, and we're committed to doing that. We're going to do that with urgency, but we're going to make sure that as a country we've got world-class legislation that's going to set us up to make sure that we're able to deal with weather events and states of emergency.
Legislation is one thing, but it's hardware, isn't it? It's actually infrastructure. I mean, in 2017, to be fair, the last government, they looked at this issue of a common operating platform for all of the emergency agencies, so they were all on the same song sheet when something happened. That seemed to have got ditched, as did the upgrade to the 111 system. They went with a slightly smaller option there. Why do we need legislation for these? Why can't you just look at the business case for these, which has been done, presumably, and get on with it?
Well, because the legislation, everything flows from the legislation. It codifies and clearly explains command and control, responsibilities, communications. That's the building block. We've got to have a solid platform, and everything will flow from that. And that's why it's so critically important that we get this legislation right.
Yeah, well, as Phil Pennington mentioned this morning, though, the last minister said the same thing, and it took too long. And in the interim, you're going to have potentially another, heaven forbid, and touch wood, another awful natural disaster. Don't have that time?
Well, I'm not going to speak to the last government, the last minister. All I'd say is that the current legislation clearly didn't go far enough. We are committed to make sure that we do. Me personally, as the minister, I'm heavily committed to this. I have my own electorate that was deeply impacted and affected by the flooding events. I consider myself in touch with the front line. I'm a member of a swift water rescue team, and I was mobilised during those events. Right through to obviously my responsibility at a strategic level and a national level to make sure that we get it right nationally.
Look, I don't doubt you are absolutely 100% committed to this, and why wouldn't you be? But the issue will be money and whether you can get the money that is required to do this. I mean, if you just look at the 111 system, that will be hundreds of millions of dollars, let alone a national emergency platform plus warning systems that need to be upgraded. Where is the money going to come from? And secondly, would you consider taking it from climate change funding?
Well, the fact of the matter is, Corin, as incoming government, it became very obvious that, yes, we've got decaying infrastructure that needs investment, and we're committed to doing that, but we have to do that in a measured and a well-planned way, because obviously we're in a position at the moment as a country where we've been living well beyond our means, and we have to start to move back, get ourselves back in surplus again. So, but in terms of those investment decisions and budgets, those are decisions that will lie with Cabinet, and that will be part of the process that I go through now in terms of the rebuild of the legislation and clearly identifying what we need to do around mitigation and reduction for ourselves as a country as well.
But you'll bring a commitment to bring urgency to this, because you see, you can see the frustration that there's 26 reports into this last issue in last flooding issue. There's been numerous other natural disasters where there have been reports, review after review after review, recommendations, hundreds of them. I mean, how much further do we need, how much more do we need to do?
Well, I agree with you. I think we have an opportunity right now, and I think that the timing is right. We've been through Cyclone Gabriel and the awful human cost that we've all seen associated with that, and the flooding events in Auckland, and we've run out of time. We have to get this done, and we're going to do that.
All righty, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate that. That is the Police Minister, Mark Mitchell. All right, some big news for people in Christchurch this morning. The Christchurch Council has confirmed a multi-million dollar deal to save the future of its famous agriculture event, the AMP show. Now, the event's been running since 1863, but faced cancellation this year due to a lack of money. Now the council has stepped in, signed a deal with the Canterbury AMP Association, injecting $5 million to support the future of the event. With us now is Christchurch Councillor Sam McDonald. Good morning, Sam.
Morning, Corin. How are you?
Very well. Okay, $5 million. Will this mean we'll have an AMP show this year?
I would like to think so. I mean, really, that'll be a matter for the board to consider. But, I mean, I would just note that we negotiated this before they announced they're cancelling it this year. So, You know, there might be some changes they need to work through at the end. But, look, it's a decision for them. We've done everything we can at our end.
What, so you negotiated a $5 million deal to keep the AMP show going, knowing that it might not be on this year?
No. So to be very clear, what's happened here is there's a lease in place, a long-term lease on the land. So it was signed in about 2015, which, because of the situation with the AMP show, has rendered it useless effectively. They're not big enough to do anything with it. And we've said actually we could use it for park space for the people of Christchurch, but also for a couple of other purposes and some changes we've made internally. So we've gone to them and we've worked with them and said actually that land is worth quite a bit. If we buy it, we'll buy it for $5 million. We can rezone some of it and dispose of that. We can keep another part of it. And then the difference, so the $4 million, will sit in a capital protected fund. And the interest of that every year will go towards running the AMP show. So it means basically that they won't need to come back to council every year for a handout or with their handout, and that the capital is protected. So it sort of ticks a heap of boxes because we're at a point where we can use the land in Christchurch for the community and for a couple of other purposes, get rid of some of it so it's effectively cost neutral, and then move on from there.
Right. So this was all sort of the deal that was being worked on, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have enough money in the short term to run this year's event. Is that the problem?
Well, I mean, they'll need to reassess it at their end. I would have thought that they could get on and do it. I mean, what we've been saying to them for a couple of years, though, is that the model isn't necessarily right. You know, when you're running a three-day event but you've got costs all year round, then maybe change the way you do it. So, you know, look, maybe that's some changes at their board. That could be a range of things they need to do to get that going. But, look, I'd like to think there's a show this year, but I think it's going to need a bit of...
Can you not demand that, given that you're putting in $5 million? I mean, what sort of negotiation was going on here?
Just to be clear, we're not putting in $5 million.
You've stepped in to buy the land. Could you not have demanded that as a clause that said, you know, look, hey, we can't have this thing not being on?
Well, the risk with that, though, is that you would get to a point where they'd have to dip into that $4 million. What we want them to do is get set up so that long-term that funding comes in perpetuity. The last thing we want, because I've been back to the council a couple of times, to be really blunt, for bailouts, is that to get off on that wrong footing this year. You know, they're in a situation where until, I think, last week, they hadn't paid the creditors from last year. So I guess what I'm saying is that we've done what we can. We've set it up so that long-term it works. But the board, and whether there are changes to that board, need to take place to ensure they can get a show running. Look, no one will disagree. I mean, you're from Christchurch as well. You know, it's a fantastic show and it should occur. But you need the right people running it, and I think that's where some change is needed.
Hang on, so you're saying, what do you mean, the right people running it? Do you think there should be changes to people running it?
Look, I think that the board that are operating now potentially need to reflect on how it's been for the last couple of years and whether the model works. You know, there's only so many times we can tell them that, but actually, you know, maybe it does require some new people to do that.
And again, is that part of this arrangement that it's contingent on some changes in management?
No, so the structure we've got is a trust which sits between it, which holds the $4 million. So there's an appointee from council, there's an independent person jointly agreed on, and one from their side. But the way the association structure is, there's two entities. There's effectively the members' entity, and then they appoint a board that run the show. So I guess what I'm saying is that it's a membership organisation which we couldn't put conditions on, but the members will need to reach a conclusion on whether the board should continue operating the way they are.
All right. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Christchurch Councillor Sam McDonald there with an update on the AMP show.
Well, for the first time in history, the role of the New Zealand Defence Force in the Gallipoli Anzac Day Dawn service is up in the air. Their bags were lost in transit during the Dubai floods, with uniforms and musical instruments nowhere to be seen. News Hub's Europe correspondent Lisette Raymer has been speaking to officials in Gallipoli, and she joins us now for more on this. Morning, Lisette.
Good morning.
This sounds like a nightmare. What has happened?
Yeah, a nightmare is a good way of putting it. Others have used the word disaster. A lot of panic here in Gallipoli amongst the New Zealand contingent, but also a lot of Kiwi ingenuity on display as they try and come up with a plan B of what on earth they're going to do without all of their uniforms and all of their instruments. Of course, the uniforms in particular are of concern. They desperately need them in order to be respectful and follow the protocol necessary for such an occasion, specifically that main dawn service, which involves Australia and Turkey. They really need their uniforms to be able to stand up there, especially, and this applies also for the Chanuk Beer commemoration that follows. Those who hold the weapons, they simply cannot be up there without those official uniforms. So at the moment, the airport has said some good news. They've located 35 of the 65 missing bags, and I've just heard from the Kiwis themselves that the first of those suitcases have started to arrive, so they're hastily trying to work out what exactly has been delivered to them, whether or not they've got some of those crucial uniforms, whether or not they've got the bugle, and what they'll be able to make work.
Oh, okay. So we don't know what's been found so far.
Not yet. Part of the issue is that a lot of people have packed two bags, so they might have just found out that one of their bags have arrived. For example, the bugler, they know they've got his bag, but they're just working out if it's the one with the bugle in it.
Oh, so okay.
A lot of very worried people.
Yeah. So what happens if the worst happens and they don't arrive? You talked about Kiwi ingenuity. How is that looking?
So what they will do, they've said, is they will go ahead with the Chanuk Beer commemoration, which is New Zealand-led, regardless of whether they have to be in plain clothes or not, and regardless of what instruments they have. And part of that Kiwi ingenuity that I've mentioned are things like the drummer, for example, has been very quickly learning how to make that official drum beat, which is so crucial to the ceremony, out of two spoons. And he has done it so incredibly convincingly. We were at the rehearsals today and I actually did think it was a drum that was making the sound, but he's just got two basic spoons from the cutlery drawer and he has turned it into that incredible sound. So that's an example. They're also, of course, got the Anzac spirit on display. They're asking Australia if perhaps their bugler could run up from Lone Pine and do the performance on our commemoration as well if our bugle doesn't show up. So a lot of camaraderie already on display here at the Anzac Cove.
Okay, well, let's hope for some good news on that front. But it is, I mean, I guess there is a certain sort of symmetry, isn't there, with the Anzac cooperation and camaraderie you talk of, if that is what it comes down to. Thank you very much for that. That was News Hub's Europe correspondent Lisette Raymer. She's been speaking to officials in Gallipoli after some of the New Zealand Defence Force's bags, crucial bags with uniforms and instruments, have gone missing on the way to Gallipoli.
A Wellington artist Vera Allen has picked up the Tate Music Prize for 2024 for her album Ideal Home Noise. The prestigious award was handed out at a ceremony at Auckland's Q Theatre last night and includes a cash prize of $12,500 from Recorded Music NZ. The album, which was released via Flying Nun Records, includes the song Carpenter.
Call the carpenter, I broke the furniture, I don't know where to sit, I think I'm gonna quit. I call the therapist, I've got an iron fist, I'm putting weight on that.
And Vera Allen joins us now, congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, you must be absolutely thrilled. This album, I've seen you describe it as a very personal one, about a difficult period in your life. To see it sort of go out into the world and do well like this must be a wonderful feeling.
Yeah, it is very, very amazing. Yeah, I'm still a little bit in shock, but it's starting to sink in now.
What, the songs themselves... What are the themes of those songs and this album?
It's a pretty heavy record. I think it was definitely, I was going through quite a dark time, so there's a lot on there about sort of depression and also just navigating life being overseas and away from family and things like that. So it's pretty heavy, but there's always this kind of run through of hope, and that's what I hope, or I feel like people are maybe connecting to about it.
Yeah, and you give up the day job now? I mean, are you still, do you get to be a professional musician? Are you on the road? How significant is this award?
I mean, it means so much to me in that way, because it basically means that I get to reinvest this money back into music. Definitely not giving up the day job, unfortunately. Doesn't quite work like that, but yeah.
Now, you're very much a Wellington-based artist, and it was recorded at the surgery with Lee Preble, was it?
With Lee.
What does that, is that a feature of your music, being in Wellington?
I'm so sorry. I literally was just, like, getting out of a taxi trying
That's
to
right.
negotiate paying the driver, and also... so I'm like...
Good on you for trying to navigate three things at once.
Okay, I'm with you now. I'm all present.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'm just curious about the Wellington factor and you know, the album. Was that, is that a part of it?
Yeah, oh, always. I feel like home is everything. But I think it was probably more because a lot of it I actually wrote a lot of it in quarantine when I just got back from the States. But yeah, I guess in that sense it's it's more the general theme of home rather than like the physical space of Wellington, yeah.
The ideal home noise.
Yeah, exactly.
No, nice. Listen, I mean, the Tate Award, when I can remember Dylan Tate, I don't know if you would have been around when he was at his height, but mm-hmm. It's a significant award, and he was an amazing champion of New Zealand
absolutely.
Music.
Yeah, oh, incredible. What a legend, like just... such an honour, like, especially just the lineup of previous artists and just all of the other nominations, like, oh my God, that's just insane.
And a win too for Flying Nun Records, is that significant?
Oh, absolutely. Flying Nun cleaned up last night and I was really stoked to represent, like, that label means so much to me and everybody part of the community and part of, like, the history. Just amazing.
So what now? Are you touring at the moment?
So I've just worked on an EP that came very spontaneously in the last couple of weeks, just a very raw, intimate demo type EP, and I'm going to release that on May 17th. Other than that, I am working really hard on my next album.
Well done. Congratulations. Enjoy the win. Thank you very much for talking to us this morning. That is Vera Allen, whose album, Ideal Home Noise, which is a great name, has won the Tate Prize, a very prestigious prize for New Zealand musicians. That was handed out at a ceremony at Auckland's Q Theatre last night. So well done to her. And that's today's Morning Report podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Do tune in tomorrow wherever you get your podcasts from.
The California Quail. RNZ National.